Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, August 19th, 2006. Today, we continue with commentary and analysis about the U.S. policy in the Middle East, as well as looking at issues closer to home. Here's what we have coming up for you. After the news, we'll hear a KSOW interview of Tiffany Burns at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. Then we'll hear from Voices of Our World with Next We Take Iran and Manifest Destiny Rides Again. Steve Diamond will bring us commentary on One Step Towards Peace in the Middle East. And Jav Parrish will speak about the meaning of the Ned Lamont victory in Connecticut. Media Minutes, a weekly review of news at the intersection of media and democracy, will come after that. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for Steve Diamond with some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. Israel violates UN ceasefire, raids eastern Lebanon. Headline and terminology corrected from a Haaretz article. An Israeli occupation force officer was killed and two others were wounded during a commando raid near the Hezbollah stronghold of Baalbek in eastern Lebanon early Saturday. Hezbollah's Al-Menar TV said the Israeli unit was transported by helicopter, which landed before dawn and was driving into the village when the soldiers were intercepted by guerrillas, who forced it to retreat under the cover of warplanes. Lebanese Prime Minister Fayyad Sinoura said the raid was a naked violation of a United Nations truce between Israel and Hezbollah. He said he protested the incident to visiting UN envoys, who would take the matter up with Secretary General Kofi Annan. Lebanese security sources said commandos in two vehicles, unloaded from helicopters, were on their way to attack an office of senior Hezbollah official Sheikh Mohammed Yazbek in the village of Badai when they were spotted and intercepted. Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri, Hezbollah's main ally in government, said he also raised the incident with the envoys. He said, "If Lebanon had launched a similar act, wouldn't the Security Council have met to impose tough sanctions against it?" He added that he saw the raid as an attempt by Israel to provoke Hezbollah into retaliating and foil the deployment of the Lebanese army in South Lebanon, but said, "I'm sure that the resistance has enough awareness and realization of the conspiracy to refrain from retaliating." Early Saturday, Israeli aircraft fired several rockets at a target in the Hezbollah stronghold in eastern Lebanon, a Lebanese security source said. The IOF said the assault aimed to disrupt arms smuggling to Hezbollah from Iran and Syria, and that such operations would continue until, quote, "an effective monitoring unit" was in place to prevent Hezbollah from rebuilding its arsenal. Hezbollah officials on the scene said overflights from Israeli jet fighters drowned the clatter of helicopters as they flew into the foothills of the central Lebanese mountains, dropping commandos in two vehicles they used to drive into the village when the Hezbollah fighters intercepted them in a field. The commandos identified themselves as a Lebanese army, but the guerrillas grew suspicious and gunfire erupted. "Truce will be Israel's last," Lebanon envoy declares, reported on August 13th, from Agence France-Presse. Lebanon's UN ambassador bitterly slammed Israel's month-long bombardment of his country ahead of a hard-won truce and vowed that the treaty would be Israel's last with any Middle East country. "Lebanon will be, I think, the last state to sign a peace treaty with Israel," UN ambassador Nuhad Mahmoud told CNN Television's Late Edition program without explaining the remark. He called the agreement a crucial test for all the parties involved. He added, "Now is the moment of truth for everyone, and we'll see who will abide by the Security Council resolutions and who will not. So what we have this week is very crucial." He also said that the 15,000 Lebanese soldiers to be dispatched to South Lebanon to help keep the peace alongside a similarly sized international UN force, quote, "are not going to use force to disarm the Hezbollah militia, which has been battling Israel. Hezbollah will just leave the area as armed elements, as I understand it, and the Lebanese army will take over the whole region along with the United Nations forces," he said. regarding the UN cessation of hostilities agreement concluded Saturday after weeks of negotiation, he said, "That could have happened through negotiation from the very first day, but the Israelis chose the escalation and chose to have this war against Lebanon to destroy the whole country and to kill more than 1,000 people. That was their choice." UN Resolution 1701, passed Friday, calls for an end to hostilities in Lebanon and the deployment of up to 15,000 UN peacekeeping troops in the south. Rice, "Not UN's job to disarm Hezbollah," from USA Today. "The 15,000-member UN force being created for southern Lebanon will keep the peace and enforce an international arms embargo," Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said Tuesday, "but it won't be charged with disarming Hezbollah guerrillas." "That political agreement will be the responsibility of the Lebanese," Rice said in an interview with USA Today. "In the past, the Lebanese government has been unwilling or unable to disarm Hezbollah, a movement that is now part of the government itself. A United Nations resolution on the books since September 2004 has called for all Lebanese militias to disarm." Rice said, "I don't think there is an expectation that this UN force is going to physically disarm Hezbollah. I think it's a little bit of a misreading about how you disarm a militia. You have to have a plan, first of all, for the disarmament of the militia, and then the hope is that some people will lay down their arms voluntarily. If Hezbollah resists international demands to disarm," Rice said, "one would have to assume that there would be others who are willing to call Hezbollah what we are willing to call it, which is a terrorist organization. Hezbollah would find itself increasingly isolated from European and other nations," she said, "and the weapons embargo would prevent it from being rearmed by its sponsors in Syria and Iran." Critics have argued that Hezbollah's political support has soared in the region for its success in standing up to Israel's armed forces. Rice said Hezbollah's military strength has been undercut and predicted that any political benefit for the group would be, quote, "very short-lived." And from the International Herald Tribune, Hezbollah hands out cash for rebuilding. Villagers danced in the streets and threw rice as the Lebanese army reached the southern border with Israel for the first time in decades, and Hezbollah volunteers proceeded with a vigorous and fast-paced reconstruction campaign, handing out grants of $12,000 in stacks of American dollars to families whose houses had been destroyed in the past month. The landmark deployment came as mass funerals were held across southern Lebanon for hundreds of people killed in the recent bombings, including scores of Hezbollah fighters who were hailed as heroes and martyrs. Sirens wailed as ambulances made way for funeral processions, and the stench of dead bodies pervaded the streets. Even as southern residents cheered the arriving Lebanese army, Hezbollah banners waved nearby, and the group's members made clear that they have no intention of giving up their weapons. Lebanese government officials have said that the 15,000 soldiers being sent to southern Lebanon will not search for weapons. The equal number of United Nations peacekeeping troops expected to join the Lebanese army will not be expected to do any disarmament either, UN officials say. Whatever the fate of its weapons, Hezbollah has already asserted itself politically across the south, distributing food and aid in advance of the international relief groups that are also in the area. Lebanese and American political leaders have expressed frustration at Hezbollah's rapid and effective disaster relief and at Iran's apparent role in providing hundreds of millions of dollars for that purpose. West Bank pullout off the agenda as Omer counts cost of failed war, from the Independent of Britain. In the face of plummeting approval ratings in the wake of the war in Lebanon, the Israeli Prime Minister has shelved plans to pull out of the West Bank and is struggling to ride out a growing public storm over the government's wartime bungles. On the domestic front, the fighting in Lebanon, along with Israel's ongoing offensive against militants in Gaza, appears to have discredited the idea of unilateralism. Israeli troops left Lebanon in 2000 and Gaza in 2005, in both cases without a peace deal. A top Omer aide, Asaf Sharif, confirmed the policy shift. He said, "Right now, we will deal with other issues. It's not that the pullout was canceled, but it is not on the agenda." That strips Mr. Omer's coalition of its main reason for being, making another attempt to resolve the Palestinian conflict. The next election is not scheduled until 2010, but, in the past decade, no Israeli government has survived a full 4-year term. Polls suggest that a majority of Israelis are not demanding Mr. Omer's resignation, for now. And from NBC5.com, tension builds on Israel-Gaza border. There was tension in Gaza near the border with Israel, where two shootings were reported Friday. According to Palestinian medical officials, Israeli soldiers killed one militant and wounded another. The Israeli army said the pair were involved in what they described as suspicious activity. And from the New York Times, Fearful Iraqis avoid mosques as attacks rise. Across central Iraq, more and more Iraqis associate the neighborhood mosque, the cornerstone of life in the Muslim world, with the Kalashnikov rather than the Quran. Exploding sectarian violence has undermined the mosque's traditional role as a gathering place, further unraveling the country's communal fabric. Mosque attendance has plummeted, according to clerics and government officials, as tens of thousands of Iraqis choose to pray at home out of safety concerns. Gatherings at Friday prayers are sometimes one-tenth the size of what they once were, and parents no longer send their children to mosques for spiritual lessons. As a result, sale of CDs with religious lectures have boomed, while satellite channels showing bombastic clerics are more popular than ever. The decline in mosque attendance is a noticeable reversal of a trend that began right after the American invasion of 2003, when religious freedom flowered and worshippers, especially long-oppressed Shiites, flocked to mosques. Now, however, mosques have become a frequent flashpoint in the widening Sunni versus Shiite warfare. Assaults on mosques have risen steadily since 2003. Militias regard mosques as either places of refuge or tempting targets. Entire congregations have been wiped out by car bombs. Gunmen abduct imams and sometimes shoot them outright. American and Iraqi forces often storm the buildings hunting for guerrillas. Airstrikes obliterate minarets. Violence around mosques is so rampant that in June the government imposed a curfew on Fridays from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., the peak prayer time. Imams walk around with handguns stuffed in their robes, and many mosques look more like prisons than prayer halls, fortified with concertina wire, metal detectors, and guards behind mounted machine guns. Sheikh Dulaimi said, "As imams, our main job in the mosque is to call for reform, for goodwill, for worship. Now it's tougher to do that because fewer and fewer people are coming to the mosques." Sheikh Adhami said, "We're targeted by all the armed groups. If it's not Muqtada al-Sadr threatening us, it's Al-Qaeda or the Islamic Army of Iraq. If you don't take a stand against the Americans or the Iraqi government, Al-Qaeda will target you." And from the Associated Press, troops express worries about Iraq. "President Bush is not frustrated over the slow progress in Iraq," the White House insists, "but a lot of other Americans are, apparently including U.S. troops." White House spokesman Tony Snow took pains to deny a report Wednesday that Bush had privately expressed frustration with the Iraqis for not appreciating American sacrifices made there, and with the Iraqi people and their leaders for not supporting the U.S. mission. "We don't expect an overnight success," Snow said when asked Bush's opinion on the government of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. "Just when success might come, and whether it is even possible, are key questions for war-weary Americans. And the latest setbacks in Iraq come as congressional elections near." Troops are also disgruntled over Iraqi efforts, according to questions put to Marine General Peter Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he visited the country over the weekend. One asked how much more time the Iraqi government should be given to achieve the political unity needed to stabilize the country. Another wanted to know whether U.S. forces will stay if Iraqis descend into all-out civil war. Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, sounded one of his recurring themes at a recent committee hearing. "Iraqi politicians must get the message that U.S. troops can't stay indefinitely and should make political compromises to stop insurgents and avoid all-out civil war." Charles Pena, a fellow at the Coalition for Realistic Foreign Policy and George Washington University's Homeland Security Institute, said, "There's a certain irony if military and political leaders seem to be losing patience with the Iraqis. We're the ones who created this situation." U.S. generals say Iraq could slide into a full-blown civil war if the killing isn't tamped down. Though they'd hoped U.S. troop levels could be reduced this year, officials have extended some tours of duty, sending 5,000 additional Americans to Baghdad to help with security. The total there now is some 133,000.
"Hey, Mr. President, take a look at my life. I'm 32, don't know what to do. I wanna raise a family, oh, what should I do? Don't wanna raise a soldier or two. Little boy, ask the color of the day. We in high alert, can we go out and play? I don't wanna raise a child like that. Don't wanna raise a soldier or two. asked why is that? All the flags are flown half-staff. I don't want to raise a child like that. Don't want to raise a soldier or two. Sirens are sounding, get back inside. Head for the shelter, it's time to hide. I don't want to raise a child like that. Don't want to raise a soldier or two. Mommy and Daddy are down on their knees. Their son's been called Uncle Sam's in need. 18 years old, they said no draft, but the little boy's heading overseas. The little boy's heading overseas.
That was Hey, Mr. President by E.J. Hatatax. Just like last August, Cindy Sheehan, anti-war mother of a soldier killed in Iraq, and her supporters have established Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas, close to George Bush's ranch. Here's an interview of one of the organizers at the camp, recorded on August 15th.
This is Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We have on the phone Tiffany Burns, who's an organizer for Gold Star Families for Peace and also Code Pink. And Tiffany is at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. Hello, Tiffany.
Hi, Scott.
How are things going down there?
Things are actually going along really, really well. Spent the last week out here building up the camp and, you know, really giving life to a permanent home for Camp Casey. So it's grown from just being a plot of dirt to this amazing space with the tents and crosses, and we're building a memorial on Thursday for Iraqi children and women that have been killed in the war. It's really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So you've been there since, I think, Cindy and others returned there on, and perhaps you, on the 6th of August.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And I know a lot of people are wondering and concerned that it was a few days ago that Cindy went into the hospital for probably heat exhaustion, not to mention
Right. Exhaustion
in general. How is Cindy doing?
She's out of the hospital. She was released on Sunday, and she's doing a lot better. We still don't know quite what the cause was, and won't get anything back from the doctor for a few days, but her spirits are good, and she's resting and recuperating and has been, you know, popping into camp at least once a day just to kind of check on everything and be there in spirit as much as possible. So she's definitely looking forward to coming back.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. Obviously, there's lots of people, not only in this country, but around the world, that are concerned. I know Cindy had just returned from a trip to Jordan, so I know I wouldn't
Right.
be surprised if it was just exhaustion in general, having...
Right.
She's in her... I don't know if she's has ended her fast now, but at that point she was...
She did end the fast.
Okay.
She did 37 days of the fast, and while she was fasting, she was, you know, continuing to work, so she was traveling quite a bit. She did two international trips, including a trip to Italy, and then just before she came to Crawford, she went to Jordan, and then reached Crawford, where it's like 105 degrees every day in the shade. So I think it was just a combination of that and, you know, the heat, the travel, the fast, and then, you know, whatever else just kind of naturally happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that in a couple of days you were planning to build a memorial for Iraqi children and women
Right. Killed
Right. In the war. Tell us more about that, but also any other plans that are coming up here for Camp Casey.
Sure. Well, Cindy actually announced last week from the Veterans for Peace Conference in Seattle that she intended to use the land as a sanctuary space for war resistors or troops and their families who were interested in getting more information about their options and their right to not fight in Bush's illegal war. And so the continued plans for summer are to do activities around that. So we've been having teach-ins, and we'll continue to have, you know, we have spokespeople out here for the GI Rights Hotline. This weekend we'll be actually having some veterans in that are with the Iraq Vets Against the War. And, you know, in addition to heading out to the checkpoint whenever Bush is in town, you know, and asking just in case maybe, you know, they change their mind, that he'd be willing to meet with Cindy and answer her question. So there's a lot of activity happening through September 2nd. And on Thursday, one of the spaces, especially since we have this permanent land, which is really, really great, we've decided that right across from the area where they've set up a memorial, Arlington West crosses, we're doing a space for Iraqi children and women. So it'll be a peace garden. Mm-hmm. With flowers, and then around it, we're encouraging people to mail children's shoes to the proper peace house, or they can also make a donation at the Code Pink website, which is just codepinkalert.org. And we're starting a garden and, you know, building a memorial, and hopefully it's not going to get that big, but we want something to be there to represent the lives that have been lost.
Mm-hmm. So you said you're running Camp Casey through September 2nd.
Right.
And then some folks are shifting back to Washington, D.C., is that right?
Right.
Okay.
And so some people will be heading out and moving to Camp Democracy, which will be happening in D.C.
So what? About how many folks are there right now? And I'd also like to ask you, so far with this, just a little over a week, this edition of Camp Casey, I guess you're calling it Camp Casey 3, is that right? What are some highlights for you?
Well, we've had about 100 people come in and out. You know, every day more people show up. During the week, it's been a little slower. Initially, we didn't intend to be out here until September 16th. So this is really our kind of big opening weekend. But we found out, August 16th, who was supposed to be the opening weekend of Camp Casey. But we found out that Bush was going to be here from the 2nd until the 14th. And so plans shifted up quite a bit, and we headed to Crawford. So I arrived the same day that Cindy arrived. And, you know, one of the most striking things, when we were here the very first day, we marched up to the checkpoint from the spot where they started last year. And it's about 2.5 miles. And as we were walking along, there was a mom walking with us, and we were just talking, and she had a picture of her son on a t-shirt, and she's holding a poster. It's a beautiful poster of her son, and she said that she was out here last year at Camp Casey with Cindy, and her son was in Iraq, and he was actually in the military at that time, and in November he was killed. And she said, you know, I never would have imagined that I would be coming back this year as the mother of a troop that had died. And I just can't tell you how profound that was as we were walking up to the front, you know, of the checkpoint with Cindy, you know, there in the front, marching along, and there's this mom that says, you know, I was here last year when my son was alive. It's definitely, you know, just, you don't need any more inspiration than that to maintain the vigil.
Wow, so last year she was there, obviously, partially, if not mainly,
right,
to hope that her son would not be killed in this illegal war, and then it turns,
right,
out now she's there to hopefully memorialize him, but also to hope beyond hope that no other mothers and fathers, sons or daughters will be killed there. But,
absolutely.
Wow. Well, you are an organizer for Gold Star Families for Peace and Code Pink. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, what brings you to this, and how you got involved in Code Pink and Gold Star Families?
You know, I actually worked at a transitional housing facility for homeless veterans,
mm-hmm,
for the last 4 years before I started working full-time for Code Pink last year. And so I am, you know, after watching vets come in and seeing just the correlation between being in military service and especially combat service, and then, you know, what that really does to somebody,
mm-hmm,
I felt like it wasn't enough to be working at an organization that treated them when they got home. I wanted to stop troops from being sent over there, especially because I'm, I come from a military family. My dad was in Vietnam and then got out but rejoined the Navy and was in until I was in high school when he retired. And so I feel, a really strong connection with other military families and have a lot of empathy for what they're going through right now. And so I just, ended up in Crawford last summer and have it's taken me in a whole new direction, but it's been really amazing.
Yeah, well, you're doing great work, and we all appreciate it. Is there, what would you say to folks, what are the things that are most needed by folks, aside from, of course, encouraging anybody that can make it down there to join Camp Casey, what are some other ways that folks can help out?
Well, if they can come, we have a lot of activities happening for the next couple of weeks. If they're not able to make it, they can definitely, any financial support is always welcomed. This is a total volunteer operation, and so everything that's happening here is just by these amazing people that have kind of showed up and made offerings. People can make a donation. They go to campkc3.org. And that will go to directly fund the activities that are happening down here for the rest of the summer.
Okay.
Continued actions.
Is there some kind of scholarship fund or something? Anybody trying to raise money to help send some folks that need to be there but can't afford to make the trip?
Well, our main focus right now, especially is if there are military families or war resistors that are wanting to be here, there definitely, is support there, and we want to bring as many troops and families possible here. And so if that's something that they would be interested in, they can find contact information for Gold Star Families for Peace, and they are providing support for that. If they go to GSFP, goldstarfamiliesforpeace.org.
Okay. Well, perhaps that's something on a community basis. If a community could get together and decide to send one or two folks themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Okay. Anything else you'd like to share with folks before we cut this off?
I would just say that, the other really striking thing that has happened since last summer, almost 800 troops have been killed, and that's pretty amazing when we've been putting together a memorial, and just 800 crosses alone to signify that was really significant to know how important it is to continue to have not only a presence in Crawford, but everywhere that Bush is, to pressure the government, the U.S. government, to take actions to get our troops out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to be out of there now. We need to be out of there yesterday. We can't continue to let this happen. And so if you can't be with us here in Crawford, you need to take action in your community to do something.
Okay, and there's plenty of opportunities coming up. That's one
Absolutely.
Of the...
Absolutely. People can get involved. The websites that I mentioned were Gold Star Families for Peace, GSFP.org. They can also go to CodePinkAlert.org. And if they're specifically interested in joining us here at Camp Casey, they can go to campcasey3.org.
Okay. Well, Tiffany, as I said, we appreciate your effort, the time and energy you're putting into this, and spending a little bit of time with us here so we can alert the folks in our local community and on the Internet. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Yeah, have a great time. I hope you'll get some kind of cooling trend down there, and it'll drop to maybe 103 or something.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Every degree counts.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Tiffany Burns, organizer for Gold Star Families for Peace and Code Pink. She is currently at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. For more information or ways to get involved or ways to donate, please go to CodePinkAlert.org or GSFP.org for Gold Star Families for Peace, their website. If you are interested in perhaps going to Camp Casey or giving donations to help them keep functioning down there, go to campkc3.org.
Casey was a good boy. He treated people well. His mama loved him. Anyone could tell. She'd send him off to school, pack his lunch with care, and when he came back home, she hugged him with her fingers in his hair. Cindy, she loved Casey, and when all is said and done, she is every mother, and he was every mother's son. When Casey was a little older. He spent his time each week in that church in Vacaville, in the service of the meek, in the service of his city, in the service of the Lord, with his mama in the pews, all the time they could afford. If their love alone could save us, then the world would be one. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. People thought the priesthood was where he'd someday be, so some folks were surprised when he joined the army. The recruiter told him he didn't have to fight. Cindy hoped this was the case and prayed for him every night. That was before they sent him to the desert with a gun. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. His truck had no armor, and when it came under fire, it and half the soldiers in it became a funeral pyre. Cindy, she was sleeping the moment Casey died, and she knew she'd never see him standing by her side. There was no consolation, no safe place she could run. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. The president, he told her, he died for a noble cause. Now Cindy's wondering exactly what that was, 'cause they never found the weapons. And now that Casey's gone, it seems that oil's the game, and Casey's the pawn. Cindy's got some questions, yes, and so does everyone. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son.
That was David Arovics with Song for Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Making Waves. We next bring you two segments from Voices of Our World. The first is entitled Next We Take Iran, and the second is Manifest Destiny Rides Again.
Listen to the voices of our world.
It's clear that our policy in the region is about something bigger than just this so-called war on terror.
Those within the administration figured that, well, we're this far, why not move on and achieve some other goals, such as greater control over the oil region?
If the United States can control the Persian Gulf, it'll have its hand on the jugular of the rest of the world.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. In the life of an individual, and in the history of a nation, there come along what one may think of as diving board moments. I mean those crucial moments leading to that point of no return. The moment after you've jumped up and down several times on the tip of a diving board, thinking through your intention, until you're at that Rubicon millisecond, suspended in midair, when it becomes irrevocably clear there's no going back. Not even if there's no water below. As a nation, we had a diving board moment when our leaders took us to war against Afghanistan, not Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and when we went to war against Saddam and Iraq, not Osama. So today we'll look again at the push for war with Iraq and what may in fact signal a Bush-Cheney design on an expanding domination of the Middle East, including forcing a confrontation with Iran. Today we'll talk with two internationally respected journalists and authors, Robert Dreyfus and Peter Arnett.
The pinky and the brain, yes, pinky and the brain. One is a genius, the other's insane.
It was a very funny, satirical cartoon series, written clearly for an adult audience. Pinky and the Brain was spun from the more mischievous side of Uber producer-director Steven Spielberg. The duo, a pair of lab rats, were a skinny, simpleton rodent, sounding like a cross between Stan Laurel and Dudley Moore, Pinky, and his Svengali-like leader, a shorter and rounder vermin with a voice meant to mimic the late Orson Welles, the Brain. Not quite so funny. I can't possibly be the only person who sees a resemblance between Pinky and the Brain and our real-life fearless leaders, Bush and Cheney. At the beginning of each episode of the cartoon series, Pinky would ask the Brain,
"What are we going to do tonight, Brain?"
And the Brain would always answer,
"The same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world."
The comparison is feeling less and less funny to me. Recently, for TomPaine.com, Robert Dreyfus wrote, "The attacks of 9/11, the 21st century's Pearl Harbor, allowed Vice President Dick Cheney, along with Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, John Bolton, et al., to steer President George W. Bush and the U.S. government toward a global war. The invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, the endless war on terrorism, and the militarization of American foreign policy." Some have traced the neocon petroleum pursuit all the way back to the writings and speeches of American-educated Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu, considered the real father of the War on Terror doctrine. In a piece written for the July-August issue of Mother Jones, Dreyfus tells us that Elizabeth Cheney, the vice president's daughter and a top State Department official, has created a brand new office of Iranian affairs at State and supervises an office called the Iran-Syria Operations Group. Robert Dreyfus is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone, The Nation, and Mother Jones, and the author of The Devil's Game, How America Unleashed Fundamentalist Islam. Kathy Golden recently talked with Robert Dreyfus about his article in the July-August edition of Mother Jones magazine. Next, we take Tehran, and what may be our country's next diving board moment.
It's clear that our policy in the region is about something bigger than just this so-called war on terror. And it's no surprise that so many of the fighting wars that we're engaged in are somewhere in the vicinity of the Persian Gulf or Central Asia because of the energy supplies. And what I believe is a primary motivation for our involvement in that part of the world, but also specifically in relation to the confrontation with Iran, especially as the rest of the world, China and India and other parts of the third world, begin to develop industrially and start to build highways and build automobiles, you're going to see the demand for energy in those parts of the world start to come up to approximately the level of that in the United States. And if the United States can control the Persian Gulf, it'll have its hand on the jugular of the rest of the world.
Now, Bob, the particular article that you've written recently for Mother Jones on Iran, you go into great detail about alliances that have been building all along between Russia, China, and Iran. So wouldn't the United States be privy to the same knowledge you are, and wouldn't they be thinking, well, the ship has sailed?
Well, Iran is really a battlefield. In a way, it's up for grabs because it's a small country. Now, it has an enormous amount of the world's oil and gas within its boundaries. And it also sits in a very strategic position in terms of dominating the rest of the Persian Gulf, and specifically the mouth of the Gulf through which all the oil tankers pass. But it's still a weak country, and there are a lot of great world powers that are struggling for influence or even control in Iran. China is going to become the world's greatest consumer of oil and natural gas fairly soon because of their voracious demand for these fuels. So the Chinese have built an organization called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that includes Russia and it includes four Central Asian republics, the STANs, and they've recently been offering membership to Iran, and it's kind of meant, I think, as a counterweight to NATO or to the Western economic alliances, trying to link these energy-hungry nations like China with the energy supply nations like Central Asia and Iran. And it's clear that it's meant as a deliberate counterweight to the United States. So the struggle over the Gulf and Iran has international or global dimensions that go far beyond simply Iran's efforts to acquire nuclear technology.
In looking back at the run-up to the second Gulf War and where we are now in Iraq, at this point in time, what would lead Bush to believe they could actually get away with starting another war of any kind in Iran? Tony Blair can't possibly think that this could fly.
Well, that's a very good point, but I'm not sure that they're seeking war with Iran in the immediate future. It could happen. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the carnage there has escalated the crisis to the point where the Israelis have put confrontation with Syria and Iran back on the table. And sure, we could wake up tomorrow and find out that either Israel or the United States or both have launched cruise missile attacks and bombing raids against Iran's nuclear facilities. But I think much more you have to think of it as a fork in the road. A couple of months ago, it looked like some of the adults in the Bush administration, like Condi Rice, just like Colin Powell tried before her, tried to steer the United States back onto the path of diplomacy and negotiations. And, of course, they launched that famous opening to Iran for diplomatic talks. That was opposed by Dick Cheney. The neoconservatives denounced it as a sellout, as a blunder. So the other path in the fork in the road is the path of confrontation. And whether that means war sooner or later is up for grabs. I mean, I put in my article that Bush might attack Iran before the election. He might wait until next year, or he might simply continually just kind of escalate the showdown over things like sanctions and embargoes and, you know, stirring up resistance, revolts inside Iran among ethnic and minority groups. There are a lot of things that are options short of war as well. But I think it's more constructive to think of it in terms of the path of confrontation versus the path of negotiation. And down that confrontation path is where the neocons want to go, again, in pursuit of unilateral American hegemony in that part of the world.
But now back to what you were saying about the forks in the road, et cetera, and where we're going. And one wonders when you see them pandering to James Dobson's crew and the Left Behind folk, do they really, really want this? Is what we see now in the Middle East, is that part of the orchestration?
Well, definitely there's an affinity among both the neoconservatives and the Christian right, what's sometimes called the Christian Zionists, for Israel. And I believe that what Israel is doing is partly an attempt to outflank the moderates in the Bush administration and to re-energize both the neoconservatives and the Christian zealots, to allow them to come back to the kind of prominence they had between 9/11 and the war in Iraq in March of 2003. That was their zenith, their high point. And as the war in Iraq began to go awry and bog down and then finally descend into this murderous, horrible carnage that we see every day, they began to lose influence in the Bush administration. And I wouldn't be surprised that even Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld himself is, you know, sort of had it up to here with the advice of people like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith, who are no longer at the Pentagon. So there's been a kind of eclipse of neoconservatives in the Bush administration. And I'm concerned, of course, that they're going to try to make a comeback. And if they do, there's no telling where it could lead. But certainly confrontation with Iran is one sure bet.
And Seymour Hersh has written on these subjects as well, and he's said that we already have folks inside Iran. Is there any evidence that that is the case?
You know, I've read what Tsai has written, and I have no reason to doubt it. I think it's probably right. On the other hand, you know, we have CIA people all over the world doing their skullduggery, and so it doesn't necessarily follow that we're planning an attack. It could be anything from intelligence gathering to simply, you know, building up allies and assets on the ground to maybe even some covert operations aimed at destabilizing Iran a little bit. But I don't know that that necessarily implies that we're going to launch massive bombing raids. But of course, if we do, one of the things that the neocons are counting on is that these bombing attacks, which would probably last, you know, many weeks and would have repeated strikes at up to 50 different sites where there's nuclear research going on, they're counting that these would have an enormous effect inside Iran, would shake up the regime, would create some sort of chaos there after which I guess they hope some sort of government more friendly to the United States would come into being. I mean, I just don't see the logic of it. It seems to me that not only would it strengthen the regime if they're under attack, but also if a new government did come to power, it would be more hostile rather than less hostile to the country that attacked it. So I don't know, but I suppose if we do go to war in that sense, that it's good to have, you know, from their point, good to have CIA people on the ground to try to, you know, push their candidates to, you know, take power, to exercise influence and so forth. But to me, it seems like an utter fool's game.
Unfortunately, again, you are probably right. Robert Dreyfus, June-July issue of Mother Jones, Next We Take Iran. Fascinating stuff, and thank you so much for talking with us today, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks, my pleasure.
This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
American journalist and diplomat John Lewis O'Sullivan, in an editorial supporting the annexation of what is now the state of Texas, was the first to put in print the jingoistic term manifest destiny. The tenet expresses the belief that territorial expansion for the United States was not only inevitable, but divinely ordained. I guess not much has changed. Similar thinking may have been involved when Christian right evangelist Pat Robertson benignly mentioned that the assassination of Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez might be appropriate. As has been pointed out before, it appears what should rightfully be our oil seems to be trapped under his third-rate country and that giant sandbox known as the Middle East. But prior practitioners of imperialism may be predictably more apt at reflecting on the failures of political arrogance. The BBC recently reported that UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has opined that Britain's imperial past may be responsible for many modern political dilemmas, the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Kashmiri dispute, among others. After World War II, it was the Brits who pasted together the country we now know as Iraq, from what was originally three Ottoman provinces. And if misery does love company, it may be reassuring to members of our Congress today that Winston Churchill once wrote to Prime Minister David Lloyd George, "Why are we compelled to go on pouring armies and treasures into these thankless deserts?" Why indeed? Well, there is the oil. And then there's the spoils of privatization, contractor heaven, and just plain war profiteering. Kathy talks with author, war correspondent, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Peter Arnett.
13 years in Vietnam, both Gulf Wars. What drives war after war in the first place? Is it the defense industry and people's interest in those industries?
That is all part of it, of course, Kathy. The U.S. has a very large standing army. It has a professional officer corps. You know, certainly since World War II, you know, it has aspired to be the most important power in the world. The defense industry has provided the weaponry and the technology to allow the U.S. to be the greatest power in the world. So certainly those who are within that structure, within the Defense Department, and those who are elected to office, and those who are, you know, the governments that come to the people who go to office are ambitious, and they have around them people with agendas. You know, if you elect, you know, a president with those around him who really believe that U.S. power can change the world, then you have, say, a Vietnam, in which those around President Kennedy and Johnson, like Robert McNamara, thought it would be relatively simple to democratize, you know, distant parts of the world. Or as you have around President Bush, those like Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and former Assistant Defense Secretary Wolfowitz, who believed it would aid America's, you know, your power ambitions to move to, say, the Middle East aggressively. And it's all part of the whole equation, right? Strong army, strong defense department, strongly, you know, ideological people in the White House and the Defense Department. It all comes together in war. And if you know, the media would hope would be a balance and a controlling factor. And I think during the Vietnam War and the years afterwards, the media was, you know, a significant factor in American policy, foreign policy. It did challenge, you know, the government fairly successfully, even though Reagan got away with the Central American policy. Because even so, people were aware of it, almost led to his impeachment, the Iran-Contra affair. 9/11 came, and the U.S. Government and people quickly got back to sort of a World War II mode, believing at the time that the country was imperiled, and sort of responding to the clarion call of those who believed that the U.S. should strike out. When indeed those within the administration figured that, well, we're this far, why not move on and achieve some other goals, such as greater control over the oil region, you know, getting rid of people we personally don't like Saddam Hussein. I mean, President Bush said that this is the guy that tried to kill my dad, you know, before the war. So sort of was a personal vendetta. Why not go and do it? We have the weaponry, we have the people, we have the power. And they just walked into Iraq not even heeding the suggestion that, wait a minute, this is a warrior country, and they may not like it.
You kept in touch, I know, with General Westmoreland for some time after Vietnam. Did he ever let down his guard and have any hindsight thoughts?
You know, that is a very good question. And, in fact, I did occasionally see him. He died last year. But I did occasionally bump into him. Well, the fact that he was quite personable to me and friendly indicated that, you know, whatever doubts or suspicions he had about the media, which he seemed to suggest in Vietnam, he had come to terms with that. In fact, he did tell me a few times that, you know, I did a lot of stories out of Vietnam for the Associated Press, maybe 3,000 or 4,000, that he basically didn't quarrel with what I said. He was very angry with one story in which I wrote that each morning he had a tennis lesson or played tennis with a tennis pro at the sports club in Saigon for relaxation and for exercise. And on the basis of that story, he stopped playing. And he said that was the one that hurt him the most. So now what does that say about the general? But he seemed to, I think, in the end, believe that the media was justified in challenging in the war, even though he said specifically in terms of battle to battle, he felt that the U.S. had achieved its goal there. You know, Westmoreland was not an ideologue. I mean, he was a professional soldier who was given a very tough job in Vietnam and failed at that job and paid for the rest of his life. He paid for it. He was looked at as being, you know, incompetent, stupid. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, he had some aspects of his personality and character, which we sort of need in our military man today.
Yeah, well, just telling that story, Peter, it just occurred to me that those of us who remain huge fans of yours, it has a lot to do with being able to say that the emperor has no clothes. You've been excellent at ticking off a lot of people, all the right people.
Well, that comes with the territory. You don't forget, you know, I was very high profile organizations I worked for, the Associated Press, then CNN, and the higher you get up, the higher you get up in shall we say prominence of the organization, the greater effectiveness you were. And I thought I was the proudest part of my career was that I was able to challenge authority for, you know, 40 years. From the highest pinnacles of the news organizations, the mainstream news organizations, and basically resist attempts to sort of, as you say, dethrone me or to destroy my career.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're talking with journalist and author Peter Arnett.
It was only at the end of my career, you know, when I was 69 years of age, and covering Iraq for NBC, that they basically were able to say, put me off the air. I think that's not a bad record, Kathy.
It's a great record, Peter. lastly, at this point in your career, which is far from over, and with an eye to the title of the book that you've just accomplished, Feet to the Fire, I'm wondering what, when all is said and done, are your satisfactions and or your dissatisfactions?
With the media?
Yeah.
I had hoped for a long time that advances in technology and the advances of information gathering and dispensing that information, you know, to people in the U.S. and around the world would be a tremendous advantage for the public and understanding what was happening in the world. And as more news organizations grew with the arrival of, say, CNN 24-hour news, that when it was started by Ted Turner, that was ridiculed, the idea that people wouldn't want 24-hour news. And then you get onto talk radio, and then you have, you know, the internet and so many other, and satellite television, satellite radio. But looking at it all now, I think it adds up to a lot of sort of confusion in the public mind. I think in one sense you have, say, this phenomenon of blogging where on the internet anyone can sort of have their own, you know, their own pulpit to present their views. But I read recently there were 27 million bloggers. So just imagine trying to wade through all that material. You can't wade through all that material. And I think the public sort of has to lean just as heavily on its elected officials for information, and sort of the few remaining mainstream media that are clearly apparent for information, as it always has done in the past. What is interesting to me is that within this massive information and communications development, there has risen a very clear-cut, you know, media or clear-cut commentators and those with a political agenda. I'm talking about the right-wing agenda here. It's Rush Limbaugh and the conservative radio, which has so long dominated radio. And it's the effectiveness of Fox News, it's the Wall Street Journal. They basically speak in one voice, and certainly in the case of the Bush administration, protective of the Bush administration, slashing out at enemies, whether it's Peter Arnett or it's a Democratic politician or it's an individual that displeases the administration. You have this. It's added to the government firewall, all this cacophony of supported voices, which, you know, you don't have on the other side, the liberal side of the country. Hmm. And I think this has been dismaying. It's taken, you know, 3 years now before the reality has got through to the American public that Iraq was a bad move to make, and it's not successful. What is the future of the media? I think it's muddled. I just see the New York Times being degraded to some degree by this massive media, and some part of it its own fault. It's a sort of a confusion in the public mind. My concern is that the public will sort of continue retreating towards soft news, DVDs, you know, entertainment, and be less concerned about these important issues, which would be really unfortunate.
If the United States government is considering pursuing an expanded war in the Middle East in the name of the war on terror, are you with them or against them? Email us at radio@marynoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Robert Dreyfus and Peter Arnett are just two of the voices of our world. And I'm your host, Eileen Bott. This week's show was produced by Kathy Golden. And you heard music today by Smodge, Cole Porter and Bing Crosby, Richard Stone, and Tom Ruger. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org, where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Please go to www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll, or try Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877 877- MaryKnoll. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.